Hurricane Ian strikes, someone blows up the Nord Stream pipeline, and Joe Biden doubles down on his student debt lawlessness. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Dominic the Dom Pino, and the notorious M.B.D. Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, Fast Growing Trees, and Segura. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please, they're giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So before we get into it, I should share a word from our first sponsor of this episode, NetChoice, a trade organization dedicated to free expression and free enterprise online. Americans are rightly worried about protecting their digital security and privacy, especially with their financial information. But Congress is currently working on a bill that would weaken financial security protections. The Open App Markets Act would compel companies to allow unverified payment systems to operate in their app stores, even if those systems don't comply with important security standards. Right now, leading app stores block unsafe third-party payment systems to protect consumers from bad actors. But if passed, the Open App Markets Act would make this safety-enhancing provision illegal. Congress and Joe Biden shouldn't make us less secure online. Tell your senator to say no to the Open App Markets Act. And you can learn more at netchoice.org. So epic event this week, obviously, down in Florida. Hurricane 4 verging on a 5. I don't know, maybe it technically was it. Has been designated a 5 now. Slams into western Florida, cuts a swath across the state. Our thoughts and prayers are with everyone in this hurricane's path. The scenes on the coast where it directly hit are just absolutely stunning. Charlie, you are down there on the other coast, thank God, but Jacksonville got rained on and a lot of heavy winds for about 2 days. What should we make of this event?
Well, this was a big one. I am used to seeing hurricanes form out in the Atlantic Ocean, generate some chatter, provoke analysis and all sorts of different models, and then dissipate or turn west or stay out at sea or become tropical storms. And so it wasn't clear up until maybe 2 or 3 days ago that this was going to be a big one. But it turned out this was, in fact, a big one. I can remember being in New Orleans in 2005 at a bar. All my stories start like that. And chatting with a lady who had lived in New Orleans her whole life and saying, do you think this pending hurricane is going to be as catastrophic as some people say? And she said, no. They always say this. I'm not worried about it. Well, that hurricane turned out to be Katrina. Well, this wasn't quite that for a number of reasons. But this was certainly the worst one that we've been through in Florida since I moved here, and one of the worst in the last 20 or 30 years. All the chatter was that it was going to hit Tampa, but it ended up being Naples and Fort Myers that got hit really hard. Now, here in Jacksonville, we saw how big an event this was purely by being on the outskirts of it. I mean, it rained for 2 days. It was incredibly windy, relentlessly windy, so much so you just hear all sorts of sounds that you're not used to. Trees down, power was out, and we weren't anywhere near the middle of it. Mm-hmm. We're lucky, we're blessed. I'm not complaining, but it was a very strange couple of days. The sky was a strange color. It was still dark at 9 a.m. Goodness knows what it must have been like to be in its path. So this really was a big one, and those communities are going to need a lot of help rebuilding.
So MBD, of course, hurricanes, natural disasters, big metric for judging the performance of governors and presidents. DeSantis has been all over the place speaking with great authority. I think it's too early to render an ultimate judgment on how he's going to come out of this, because, you know, we don't know how many fatalities. We, you know, cleanup still just beginning. and search and rescue in a lot of these places. And then, you know, Biden as well, I would say both so far, given what we know, get good grades. But what's your take?
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, DeSantis has done what you're supposed to do as a governor is sort of be out in front of the cameras constantly giving updates. I've noticed people even up here in New York kind of riveted around televisions when he comes on. And I think people sense that this is a test for him that is, you know, tells us something about national politics too, not just Florida politics. So I think people are tuning in even more around the country. And I, you know, I think the national media has pegged DeSantis as like, this guy is all culture war all the time, but I actually think he has a kind of nerdy side to him, a wonky side who likes getting into the details on governing issues. I think that that's what actually made his COVID response what it was. So I'll be curious to see as the reporting comes out in the next couple of days, how he kind of used that governing style in this instance. I mean, he gave the thing that I think is going to have helped Florida was that, you know, this hurricane, everyone knew it was very serious, that it was very likely to hit the coast hard, that it was very likely to hit as a category 4. So, you know, the warnings were out in enough time to get lots of people evacuated. It's a matter of how many did, and how many of the new Floridians, how did they fare, people who were. But so, yeah, I agree. Jury's still out, but DeSantis looked fine and Biden looked appropriate, and the little handoffs they've had with each other seem reassuring.
So, Charlie, how do you think about, because you'll turn on cable news and you'll see someone's cell footage of having been, you know, on the second floor of their house with the first floor totally flooded, or, you know, stumbling out and talking to a reporter who's been doing a stand-up through the whole storm, you know, a half-destroyed house. And you kind of wonder, so why didn't they get out? So what are, having had to make this calculation, because, again, thank God you're on the other coast, but how do people think about these decisions? Because, you know, you're watching from hundreds of miles away. You're like, yeah, why didn't you just leave?
Well, I mean, I think that's a pretty complicated question, because I think there are lots of different factors that go into the way people make decisions. Certainly, if you're wealthy, it's easy to say leave. But people can't always do that. Where did they go?
Mm-hmm.
Do they have relatives? Do they have relatives who need particular medical attention? You know, so some of the people we're talking about are poor and they're in difficult circumstances to start with. And the barriers to exit as such are quite high. Then I think there are people who don't believe it's going to happen, who have been warned about hurricanes for a long time, because we get this every year. And as I said earlier, just see them turn around. And there are a few people at the edges. These people get overplayed in the media, who are just irresponsible, who either don't care about their own welfare, or in some cases actually want to stay to, you know, see it, or climb up on stuff, or go swimming, or what you will. And obviously those people are dumb. So I think it really depends on the circumstances. I mean, certainly for me, again, we weren't under threat of massive damage. The question was, where would I go? I mean, do I drive up to the East Coast towards Charleston? That, as it turns out, might have been a bad idea, given where the hurricane's heading now. Do I go west towards Alabama? Yeah, that would have worked out. We didn't know that at the time. Certainly going south wouldn't have been a good idea. So I think this is probably more complicated than...
That was my brilliant suggestion at the time, Charlie, was that you go south.
Well, I didn't do that. Yeah, yeah. I just want to add to one thing Michael said about the response from DeSantis. My view is that both DeSantis and Biden have done a really good job. And I think the way this gets framed in the press is annoying. And it's particularly annoying if you live in the place where it's happening. You know, the media cannot, it seems, just say, and I'm talking about right-wing and left-wing media here, Joe Biden and Governor DeSantis worked together on this hurricane. They have to infuse it with some sort of rivalry. Well, that rivalry exists. Governor DeSantis does not like Joe Biden, and Joe Biden does not like Governor DeSantis. But it's not in some way illegitimate for DeSantis to ask for help from the federal government because he is critical of the president or because he's critical in some circumstances of the federal government. It's not somehow hypocritical for Joe Biden to help in Florida, to talk about what he's doing in Florida, because he disagrees with the state on a lot of domestic policy issues. There's always these prefaces to these pieces. Despite having been a fervent critic of President Biden's, Ron DeSantis is asking for help. Well, yeah, because that's what the federal government is for. And in fact, you'll find almost nobody, even the most committed libertarian, who doesn't think the government is for this. I mean, certainly this is my view of what the government exists to do, right, is to deal with hurricanes or invasions or earthquakes or, you know, massive crises that really do have to be orchestrated at the statewide and then at the federal level. You will not meet anyone in Florida, especially not right now down in Naples or Fort Myers, who is interested in the differences that DeSantis and Biden have, or the Republicans and Democrats have, on other issues. It's just a total non-issue. I think they've both done really well. From what I've seen, the state response has been orchestrated exceptionally well, which you'd expect after this many years of practice. The federal response has been terrific as well. And you know, the one, if you like, political or partisan point that I would make is it is remarkable to watch DeSantis with his mastery of detail, having watched Trump for so long, because mm-hmm. you know, every single last piece of minutiae has been consumed by DeSantis in his briefings. He knows the state, he knows the numbers, he knows the budget, and it's really important. And I think if you're dealing with something like this that matters, that is the role of government, it's really important. And I find it refreshing, having lived now through you know, two presidencies in a row where that isn't the case.
So, Dominic, what do you make? This hasn't been as prominent as you might have expected, but it's a feature of the commentary around every so-called extreme weather event. Now, the idea that it's climate change that created this event. You had Don Lemon badgering an official, I think, from NOAA, who just wanted to talk about the hurricane and what might be going on with the hurricane and making sure everyone in Florida is aware of what was going on with the hurricane, badgering him to say this is climate change. You had Amy Klobuchar a week or so ago implying that you should elect Democrats and support the Democratic agenda because you wouldn't get hurricanes like you're getting we're developing with Ian off the coast then of Florida. And there's this idea that warmer waters makes it more likely that hurricanes intensify right before landfall quickly, as we saw with Ian.
Yeah, I think blaming your political opponents for bad weather is a very old instinct in our psyche. Reminds of...
You mean very old.
I'm sorry, what was that?
You mean very old.
Yes, very old.
Like medieval superstition old?
Yeah, like pagan god emperors. We sort of have a situation in the discourse around climate that whenever a conservative points to a snowstorm or an unseasonably cold day and says, where's the global warming now? We're dutifully informed that climate is different than weather, which is true, by the way. Climate is different than weather. And that's not a particularly good argument when some conservatives make it. But for some reason, when the opposite happens, when we have an unseasonably hot day or we have some kind of hurricane event like that, the left gets to trot it out as an example of climate change and an example of why we need to, then as a complete non sequitur, an example of why we need to have a carbon tax or something like that, as if that is actually a solution to preventing hurricanes. Again, if you think that the federal government has the power at its disposal to alter the weather, to completely eradicate hurricanes, you have much too high a view of government's ability to affect change in the world.
Yeah, so even if you take the premises of all the folks who say that climate change is making hurricanes stronger, and Roger Pelkey Jr., a very level-headed expert on this, says actually you can cherry-pick all sorts of studies that are completely all over the map on this question and others. But even if you accept the premises, the climate legislation that they advance, even the most radical versions, would just have the slightest marginal effect on global temperature, you know, 70 years from now. So you're talking one way or the other, having to adapt to and harden yourself against these sort of events for decades, you know, even if you adopt all of AOC's agenda right now. So there's really no alternative to doing that. MBD, while we're talking about performance, let's get in here. This really stunning moment, sad, painful to watch on a number of levels. Joe Biden is doing a hunger event, anti-hunger event, and this Republican congresswoman who died in this tragic car accident a couple months ago, major cause of hers. This is the kind of event that you would have expected her to be at. Joe Biden marked her passing in a number of ways at the time. And at this event, he's standing at the podium doing the thing every politician does at the beginning of such event, you know, mentioning the politicians in attendance. And then he goes to recognize her and asked where she is, expecting her to be in the room. How bad was this?
This was bad. This was really bad because if you have an older relative who has dementia or is suffering from early on, you know, some kind of early Alzheimer's, this is exactly the sort of thing that they forget that you worry about, is that, you know, when you know someone and they die recently, it's top of mind that they're gone. And he knew Rep. Walorski for a long, long time, and he should have remembered it, you know. And you can tell it was bad because the White House press corps kind of got all over the press secretary about this moment in a way that they've never done on any of the other kind of, you know, senior moments that get talked about in conservative media and get brushed over. This one really got talked up, and then I think the White House canceled the next day's press conference and is trying to like squelch the story. So yeah, I thought this was really ugly, and I think immediately after the midterm elections, Biden's capacity to run again is going to become the overwhelming story. We're talking like 2 days later. It's like, is Trump running? Is Biden running?
Especially if the Democrats do badly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's even crazier if they do better than expected, though. There's going to be an urge like, gosh, actually, Biden's not doing so bad. Maybe exactly. We've got to continue with him, even if a majority of Democrats in polling say they want to nominate someone else.
So I went through dementia with a family member, and people who know that often, you know, bring stories of their family members and ask what I think. And I always say that the key thing, it's not forgetfulness. So let's say Biden just couldn't remember the name of this congresswoman. You know, it's normal. It's confusion. That's the thing. And this really tipped into public confusion. And that's deeply disturbing. And then, you know, this, if Trump were in this state or any other Republican publicly while president of the United States, this would be an obsession. I mean, people are talking about it, but and certainly people on the right are very publicly, and it, but it's more subterranean conversation among everyone else. But it would be nightly news. You know, this moment would have been led every nightly news broadcast to the extent that still matters. And that's just, you know,
like every senator, every Republican senator would be asked about this.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So let's do double barreled exit questions. First to you, Dominic, your guess, inherently speculative, but your guess after all the cleanup and the rescue is done from Hurricane Ian, that Ron DeSantis's standing in Florida national politics will be better, the same, or worse?
I think probably the same. I think he's done a pretty solid job as governor of Florida. I think Florida voters have, in general, rewarded him for that. I think nothing he's going to do is going to change the negative opinion of him in the national media. Even if he did muster the power to turn the hurricane around, as some Democrats seem to believe government has power to do. So no, I don't believe there'll be any change in his standing either at the national level or the state level.
Shall I cook?
I think Dominic's right, because you don't improve your standing, especially in Florida, by being good at hurricanes. It is a prerequisite to being elected or reelected. So if you're good at it, then you're fine. If you're bad at it, you're finished. DeSantis has, it seems thus far anyway, done a good job, which is what's expected. It's the most important thing a governor can do. Had he blown this, then he would have been in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And not just at the state level, but probably nationally as well. So I think he's unchanged.
A no harm situation.
Correct.
MBD.
I agree with Charlene Dominic. I think the only thing that changes DeSantis's status nationally is what happens with re-election in November, particularly if, you know, he continues building on gains that Republicans have been making with Hispanic voters. I think that immediately raises his profile even higher than it is already, and makes him a terror to Democrats heading towards 2024.
I think maybe very marginally it helps his standing nationally. It shows he has this other mode. You know, it's not just gigantic trolling episodes like sending migrants to Martha's Vineyard. I mean, he's a figure of genuine substance, and also shows, you know, this is something Trump never got, or more likely is never capable of. It's just the best way to troll the liberals, if they already hate you, is like being really competent and good. You know, it's like he would have driven everyone crazy if Trump had been highly responsible and well-informed in his COVID briefings, right? But he just wouldn't do it, couldn't do it. And this shows, again, the promise of DeSantis adding that really important element of governance, including like, you know, being able to get things done because you know what you're doing. And that should be chalk it up as another way to troll the liberals if you're a radioactive figure the way Ron DeSantis is. Dominic, second exit question to you. Joe Biden will be able to run, ask this periodically here, will be able to run again in 2024, yes or no?
I think the answer is still yes. I believe he will still run. For all of the problems that he has, which are real and which matter, both political problems in terms of his being unpopular, and also the mental and physical problems increasingly that we've been seeing, he's still the incumbent president. He still won the Democratic primary last time, running away. I don't think there's an obvious successor that Democrats would unite around to replace him. And I think all of those fundamentals remain to his advantage, at least insofar as it means securing the nomination to run again.
Charlie?
No, I think it's going to be unsustainable. And I think we're going to see, as Michael has suggested, a return to the level of focus on his age and inability that we saw when his approval rating dropped down into the mid-30s a few months ago.
So I think this is a change for you, right? You had been thinking he would do it again?
I don't actually know, Rich. That's a good question. I may have been back and forth on this one.
MBD.
So I think he will run again, but I think he really, really, really shouldn't. And the people around him really, really shouldn't support him running again. But I just think the way this works, you know, it's just, it's very hard. You've got a whole White House full of people that don't want to be employed by Kamala Harris and don't want to raise her up. Don't have an obvious successor. And he won last time, and he may be the only Democrat that can hold some of those Rust Belt states against a Trump challenge. I think the logic is to keep with him. But I mean, I think it could be, as with many things, I think it will be a disaster.
I just don't think he's going to be able to do it. I mean, what we're seeing now, the way he's walking, these moments like with where's Jackie, they're going to get worse, and they're just going to be impossible to hide. And at the end of the day, the people who are most aware of it are Jill and Joe Biden. So I just can't see it. So with that, we go to our second sponsor of this episode and go to Charlie for the read for fast growing trees.
Fast growing trees, indeed. And I actually need a fast growing tree because one of our slow growing trees has come down. And in fact, it came down quite slowly too. It didn't topple in dramatic fashion. It slowly bent and bent and bent until it was almost at 90 degrees. And this morning it finally gave up the ghost. And that's why I need fastgrowingtrees.com, because I'm going to have to replace it. And I just don't want to wait that long. I like having a tree there. And the good news is the experts at Fast Growing Trees curate thousands of plants so you can find the perfect fit for your specific climate, location, and needs. You don't have to drive around to nurseries and big gardening centers. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped to your door in 1 to 2 days. So they're fast arriving trees too. Whether you're looking to add some privacy, shade, or natural beauty to your yard, or fill in for a once beloved and now deceased tree, Fast Growing Trees has in-house experts ready to help you make the right selection, with growing and care advice available 24/7. Even if you've never had a green thumb, which I don't, they'll make you feel like you do, just like over 1 million happy Fast Growing Trees customers across the country. And with the 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, you can trust everything will be healthy for years to come. So, as a listener of the editors, all you need to do to take advantage of this is go to fastgrowingtrees.com/editors. And you'll get 15% off your entire order now through October 31st, Halloween. Get 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com/editors. That's fastgrowingtrees.com/editors.
Thanks so much, Charlie. So MBD drama also overseas. We have these explosions, the Nord Stream pipeline creating major damage and leaks. There's a lot of speculation back and forth. Who did it? NATO countries are saying this is Russian sabotage. You had Radek Sikorski, former foreign minister of Poland, saying thank you, America, right afterwards. And a lot of people who are pointing fingers at the U.S. Held that up as evidence, including Russia and Russian outlets. What do you make of it?
Well, we don't know who did it. It does look like the Europeans are leaning toward blaming Russia. It may seem counterintuitive why Russia would blow up its own pipeline and energy weapon, you know, just before it could have its greatest effect. I have serious questions and doubts about Russia doing it, but there are theories. And one theory would be that in a way this is like burning the ships. This is, you know, it could be that Putin has decided he wants to push this war all the way. And to do so, he has to signal and make a new reality on the ground for other Russian oligarchs and other players in the Russian state that there's no going back, that there's no turning back toward normal relations with Europe. I imagine that the only actors who could have done this are state actors, or a supremely gifted terrorist group that we don't know about, but it is extremely serious, and the effect, whoever did it, I think, is to take one of the breaks off of the war, right? Like one of the ways for the war to end and to climb down is for Europe to decide the cost is too much on the energy side, or for Russia to decide that the cost of not doing normal business with Europe is too much. And that's gone away. So it looks just like another step in this ongoing and kind of quickly paced series of escalations we're going through right now, where Russia has mobilized 300,000 more conscripts. This pipeline has been blown up. Now Russia, this morning, as we are talking, has announced the annexation of 4 oblasts in Ukraine, which they don't even, where Russia doesn't fully control now militarily. Russia announced this and then said, we're open to talking with Ukraine. And Ukraine said, get out of here. We're not open to talking to any nation led by Vladimir Putin. If you have a new president, maybe we'll talk. So this just looks like people are digging in for the long term overall. And you know, even these new territories that Russia is now annexing, they're not particularly defensible. even if Russia does take them over on their own, that they don't have the kind of natural borders that are easy to defend without just building a kind of DMZ. So this looks just, all of this adds up to me is this war looks like it's going to drag on for a long time.
So Dominic, do you have a theory about the pipeline?
Oh man, I do not have a theory about the pipeline, but I do have a theory about why a single pipeline should not be a major problem for an entire continent.
Mm-hmm. What's that theory?
And it is because
sounds like a crazy one.
I know. Especially when that pipeline goes to a country like Russia. If foreshadowing my editor's pick, Andrew Stutterford has a great story in the new print issue about Europe's energy problems and about the decisions that they made over decades, really, that have put themselves in a position where they're dependent on Russian natural gas for, in the case of Germany anyway, over half of their natural gas imports. I'm sure somewhere in retirement, Angela Merkel heard news of the pipeline being blown up and said, see, we need to build more windmills. That was Germany's response for a very long time. It hasn't worked. And it's tragic to say that the solution to a lot of Europe's energy problems are to make better decisions 10 to 20 years ago. And they don't have a time machine. And so it's going to be tough for them. It's an opportunity for the United States to use some of its energy prowess in terms of filling that need. But that's not going to be an immediate solution. And there's going to have to be some really much better long-term thinking by European leaders on this. And we haven't seen much evidence of that from them in the past. And unfortunately, we haven't seen a ton of it now they're not abandoning their commitment to net zero, no matter what that means. So it's a very difficult spot, but they're in a position where they're dependent on small handful of pipelines to Russia because they thought that they were doing the right thing by basically intentionally handicapping themselves on energy policy.
Charlie.
Well, I don't have a great deal to add. I think what Dominic said is correct. This should not be how Europe is set up. I mean, it's funny, when Dominic was talking, I subconsciously expected him to say this country shouldn't be contingent upon a single pipeline. And then, of course, he said continent, which is true. We're not talking here about just one place. We're not talking about San Marino. We're talking about Europe. And the wound has been self-inflicted. And you know, I agree that much of the problem stems from decisions that were made 20 years ago. But it's not as if 20 years ago there were no augurers warning Europe against taking that course. In fact, I assume if you go back and read National Review from 2002, you'd find people saying, don't do that. So, you know, I can only hope that Europe wakes up and recognizes that you do not want to put yourself in this position. I mean, it's funny. What Dominic just accurately described is the sort of system set up that in all other circumstances, effective organizations and governments avoid. You don't have one power strip in a hospital. Data centers in California do not put their information on one set of hard drives. The single point of failure approach is rejected in all other circumstances. And yet, Europe seems to have adopted it for energy, without which nothing else can exist. I mean, this will go down in history as a lesson for the ages. And if it doesn't, then Europe won't survive those ages.
I mean, it's an interesting thing because there are other pipelines from Russia into Europe. And in fact, even going all the way to Germany, there's the YAML pipeline. But that passes through Poland. And like the whole point of Nord Stream 2 was actually to get around Poland so that Poland couldn't have its say over the flow of the pipeline or collect transfer fees. But I mean, like, it wasn't just the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, but this is partially determined by the fact that Russia is energy rich, and that is really their trump card to getting into Europe, which is internally pretty energy poor, right? I mean, unless you want to go back to coal mining, I guess, or if you wanted to go into huge nuclear development, which has slowed down over the last two decades. So this is, you know, Russia and Europe's energy drama is not over after this, but this certainly changes how a post-war settlement would go. I mean, if Russia wants to turn the taps on again to Europe, it's going to have to deal with Poland now. And Poland's been resolute. And in fact, Poland just opened up a new Baltic pipeline with the Nordic countries. So I think Europe's energy war is ongoing and could very well last beyond the Ukraine war.
And one exception to Europe's overall energy poverty is the UK, which has plenty of oil on its main oil and natural gas on its territory, yeah. But the government bans fracking.
Been reversed though.
Exactly. One of the things that the Truss government is doing is hopefully going to start to allow that for the UK. Will be much better for them, but of course everyone else is freaking out about the UK's plans, but that's one of their most promising initiatives that actually shows that they are learning a lesson from this and allowing themselves to get their own energy.
So, EBD, if you had to choose between two options for the course of the Ukrainian war going forward here in this interim period, it would be A, grinding conflict, B, a war that spirals out of control.
So what you want is 130 milligrams of potassium iodide for each adult for 3 weeks. and less than that based on the weight of your children. I'm joking, but serious. I think the series of escalations we've seen this week are terrifying. I think we are slow walking ourselves into total disaster. We have a senile president who arguably, one of my friends, Joshua Trevino, in his great newsletter, Armas, argued pretty forcefully that it seems like the Biden administration just changed the US's strategy of nuclear deterrence in Europe, and effectively invited Putin to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine.
How so?
Because he said we would respond conventionally to a nuclear detonation in Ukraine rather than what Kennedy said, which is if the Russians use a nuke from Cuba or anywhere else, we're going to completely respond as if it was an attack directly on the United States.
You're not saying that would be a better policy.
Well, I'm saying that would still scare the hell out of people, but that was the logic of deterrence, which
So do you think our nuclear umbrella should extend to Ukraine?
I don't, of course, but I do worry that the signaling is now wrong, right? I mean, it's better for there to be ambiguity if you want to stop Russia from using a so-called battlefield nuke. And by the way, I just don't think these tactical nuclear weapons, if they're used in war, I don't think world reaction is going to be like, oh, it's just a tactical nuke. I think once the taboo is broken, everything afterward is unpredictable. So I'm very concerned, especially about the next few weeks. Especially with, you know, the Ukrainian economy is looks like it could be heading into hyperinflation. Even if Ukraine is doing so gallantly on the battlefield, they still have to be able to, you know, feed and clothe their volunteers and their military. I don't know. I could see very decisive events happening in the next few weeks or it grinding on for years. I think it's a coin flip, but.
All right, so we have a very alarmist coin flip.
I'm going to continue to be alarmist about this war for a long time.
Dominic,
I'm interpreting your question, Rich, as is this more akin to Nazi Germany invading Poland, or is this more akin to the Soviet Union moving into Afghanistan? In my mind, I see more parallels with the latter than the former. I think Ukraine has shown that they are committed to defending themselves. They have proven themselves able to do that against Russia. So long as that's the case, Russia is going to have a very difficult time escalating the conflict to include other countries. I think it's going to even have a hard time escalating the conflict to include new fronts in Ukraine. I think they've shown that Ukraine has shown that they're capable of fighting and with support from allies, including the United States and other European countries. More likely outcome at this point anyway, I think is a grinding conflict that lasts for probably much longer, unfortunately.
Charlie.
Yeah, I think it'll be a grinding conflict, and I will accept at the outset that this is partly because I have a limited imagination when it comes to these things, and I simply cannot envision what would happen if a major nation of the world detonated a nuclear weapon on a battlefield outside of the only time that has ever happened, which is in the history books in 1945. I can't imagine the process. I can't conceive of the chain of events that would lead to it and that would follow. And I think as a result, it's unlikely. I hope that I am right and that Michael is wrong.
Me too.
So I think partly because I struggle to fathom how that could happen, that it will be a grind.
Yeah, that's basically exactly my attitude. I think it'll be a grind, but there is, and usually the thing that's inconceivable does not happen, right? But not always. Sometimes it actually does happen. And the combination of Putin's kind of crazed ambitions with his complete military incompetence is a really dangerous one, right? So it's terrible, I think, that he's engaged in these sham referenda to annex this territory. But it'd be one thing if he was annexing it and could actually hold it, right? But he's annexing it, and the Ukrainians could sweep right through it. At least they're encroaching on it, and you know, there could be big gains in what's supposed to now be theoretically Russian territory. And what does Putin do then? I think the answer is, you know, just continuing to ratchet up the pressure to try to get these new recruits there and, you know, more artillery. But, you know, the question of whether they're running out and push the Ukrainians back and quote unquote retake the Russian territory. But there is some potential here of a serious escalation. And I do think if he went nuclear, and again, I don't think that's likely, but, you know, a tactical nuke on a battlefield or just, you know, downtown Kiev, you know, it would really set us back on our heels. I mean, we'd have to really question our commitment and what the appropriate response is in that circumstance. And I don't think we've come close to thinking it through.
Just humor for 1 second. I mean, if you respond, I don't think there's two moves up the escalation chain, right? Like, I think if you decide to respond to such a thing with a nuclear a missile of your own aimed at something, you know, I don't know what, Vladivostok, something, I think then it's full on. There's no, you know, there's no natural stopping point then. They all get fired.
Yeah, and that's why I think you just can't. I don't think Ukraine's important enough to fight a nuclear war.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, it's like, why are we like? I understand why Ukraine why Ukraine and Russia are fighting over this territory, but like, you're gonna nuke our civilization's future over like literally the crappiest part of Europe.
Well, I mean, I think Ukraine is important. I just obviously think that it is worse to have a global nuclear holocaust than for Ukraine to be occupied by Russia. I mean, one of those things is just a lot lower down on the scale, and there's a lot more that you can do about it in the long run than you know, a civilization that's been wiped out. So of course that's the case,
right? And I guess that's why people I think the cautious, the ultra cautious people like me have feared that we are involving things like the whole credibility of the NATO alliance in this conflict, and how quickly that can begin to, obscure what you just said, which is obviously we don't want to be in a nuclear war with Russia over Ukraine. Like, that is obviously ridiculous.
But this is why I don't think the whole Russian doctrine to escalate, to de-escalate is crazy. Because I think, you know, if there's a nuclear explosion in Ukraine, there are a lot of Europeans, who are going to think, wait a minute, do we really want a piece of this? You know, do we really want to go there. But on the other side of the ledger, you know, it's if Russia's a pariah now, it would, you know, China really stick with the Russians after they've do that? Well, so there are enormous risks for the Russians as well.
And on the other side, if you don't respond, if you don't punish someone for using a nuclear weapon like that, have you just licensed Pakistan? Have you just licensed other people to begin incorporating this as a really as conventional weaponry now? That, you know, there's all sorts of horrible questions that become obvious right afterward, like all these things we really don't want to be thinking about, but they'll be confronting us immediately.
All right, so with that on a happy note, let's go to our third sponsor this episode, Segura. We know it can be difficult to make time for ourselves in this fast-paced world we live in. The stress of work, family, and the seemingly never-ending list of responsibilities we face every day are bound to take their toll. Take a step back and enjoy the finer things in life with Segura, the next generation of cigars online. Join Segura and be the first to see cutting-edge products, exclusive offers, and limited edition gear. Whether you're looking for top-shelf brands like Davidoff, industry staples like Fuente, or super rare brands like Viaje, Segura is your one-stop shop for all your cigar needs. Explore its curated selection of industry content that includes reviews, food and beverage pairings, beginner questions, and much more. Join the Segura Lounge and connect with fellow cigar enthusiasts alongside its staff, experts, and manufacturers, and be part of a one-of-a-kind cigar community. Give back to yourself. Visit Segura, that's Cigora.com, and use the checkout code REVIEW10, that's REVIEW10, to receive 10% off your first purchase. Segura, shop, connect, share. Please check it out. So Charlie, we've got some legal action around Joe Biden's unilateral student debt forgiveness. We have two legal challenges going, and amazingly enough, the reaction of the Biden administration is to say, oh, you know what, you actually the thing you're using to establish a harm and have standing to sue, we're just changing that on the fly too. So sorry, you no longer have any harm or damage, and this thing is bulletproof yet again. What do you make of it?
I consider this to be a constitutional crisis. I think that from start to finish, we are witnessing a president test the established legal order of the United States. 1 year ago, nobody thought this was legal. Nobody thought the 2003 Heroes Act justified it. Nobody would have proactively, preemptively, ahead of time, made any of the cases that the Biden administration is now making. And yet, Biden did it anyway. He knew he wasn't allowed to. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, knows that he's not allowed to. His broader party know that he's not allowed to. But he went ahead and willfully did it anyway. And then he and his cheerleaders said, in a more taunting than informative or analytical sense, you don't even have standing. And that's the point at which the constitutional crisis started. Because if there is no remedy for this sort of executive usurpation, then there is a lacuna within the Constitution that can be exploited at will. And what we're seeing this week is the president pushing that problem even further. So let's stipulate that there is an issue with standing, that one cannot easily get into the court to challenge President Biden's attack on Article 1, which invests all legislative power in the legislative branch, not in the presidency. That in and of itself, I find deeply troubling. But to have an administration that responds to the few challenges that do pop up, to the plaintiffs who say, actually, no, I do have standing because I've been injured in this way or that. By changing the law on the fly is astonishing. And to go back to first principles here, this is why we have a Congress. This is why we don't have a dictatorship. Nothing. Nothing we have seen from the Biden administration in the last 2 months related to this executive order would have been different in a dictatorship. Every decision's been executive. Biden came up with the plan. He determined the details of the plan. And now, because it's attracting criticism and legal challenge, he's altering the plan as he goes. The response to the first lawsuit filed by the Pacific Legal Foundation was to say, oh, we've changed our website. The response to the second was to say, we've made an alteration that will affect millions of people by press release. This is not how law is made in the United States. We have a Congress for a few really important reasons. One, we invite people from all across the country, every state, to help deliberate and decide what it is that we collectively want to do. That makes law better because you have more eyes on it, more input. It also makes it more legitimate. We don't let one person make these sort of calls. The second reason we have a Congress is because it's quite difficult to pass laws, which means that before you get buy-in, mass acquiescence, you need to fix problems. You need to think through the detail. You need to acknowledge and respond to criticism. And if the law ends up in pretty bad shape, even after it has emerged from the legislative branch, it's then quite difficult to just alter it on the fly. Which brings me to the third reason we have a Congress. Because it is really important for a free people to know what laws they're bound by, to be able to plan and predict and adjust their behavior accordingly. Which you cannot do if one person is in charge of sweeping issues. So we've now gone, in the space of 2 months, from a system in which people who take out student loans are expected to pay them back, although not at the moment because the president thinks we're in an emergency, to some people at a specific moment in time, within certain circumstances, are not expected to pay a certain portion of them back. We don't quite know how that'll work. We'll let you know. To you have to opt in. Here will come the paperwork when we've worked out what that's going to say. To, well, actually, not you. You don't have to pay it back. And you also do. And if you have your loan through, it's chaos. It's chaos. It is what James Madison would have considered to be tyranny. We think tyranny now is people with short mustaches and hands that go up in the air. But actually, tyranny, according to James Madison, was the investment of all power in one branch, in one person, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. And look at what we're seeing. Congress doesn't get a say. The executive gets to decide everything. And when it hits the judicial branch, the executive will just on the fly adjust it in the hope that the court will declare the case moot. No, no, no. This is a constitutional crisis. And I really fear for the future of our system if it is not remedied.
So, Dominic, it's not as though there are not bad actors on our side who will engage in all sorts of motivated reasoning to twist themselves in pretzels to justify, you know, stuff that's dubious legally. But I think it's very notable the difference in substance and rhetoric and attitude here. There's that Obamacare case that the states had brought that was a focus of attention during Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings, And the theory on the left was that she was entirely being sent to the court to overturn Obamacare on the basis of this case. And you had, you know, not every conservative, most conservatives, like, no, the plaintiffs don't have standing. It's not legit. We don't like Obamacare. We'd love for Obamacare to go away. But these plaintiffs don't have standing. Those are the rules. You know, it's not going to happen. Of course, it didn't happen. And here you have people not caring on the left about the underlying legality, the Biden action that doesn't seem to matter to them at all. And then just desperate to say, well, you don't have standing. So you can't challenge this thing that's illegal. You know, the standing thing is kind of just a taunt. They're desperate not to have anyone just so they can justify something that is frankly illegal. So it's not like this is illegal, but it's too bad no one's going to have standing because it would really be great for our system if it was overturned. It's that they're putting everything on a technicality to defend a grotesque abuse of our system.
I think that's right, Rich. And I think it's a major problem because on the right, there is a large contingent of people that very much like the Constitution of the United States. They like our system of government, and they think that it is the best thing that human beings have come up with in terms of a political organization. I don't think there's a sizable contingent on the left that believes that. And so I do think that there has been an attitude here of let's try to exploit this loophole. And it's not just an attitude that's coming from commentators or coming from university professors or some other radical fringe of the progressive movement. It's an attitude that's coming from the administration. It's coming from the people that actually have the power to make these decisions. And it is a constitutional problem. I agree with Charlie entirely. Because the purpose of government officials when they take an oath of office, which President Biden did, and which the Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona, did upon assuming his office, that says they will support and defend the Constitution of the United States, and that they will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That means you are not going to go, once in office, devise a policy aim, and then look for any loophole in the Constitution through which you can fit that policy aim. That is not what that means when you take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. So that attitude from our governing officials is fundamentally the problem here. It shouldn't have to get to this point with courts and legal standing and all the rest of this. The only reason it's gotten to this point is because of the cavalier approach from administration officials in trying to find loopholes instead of trying to do policy the right way. President Biden thinks this is a good idea. It should encourage Congress to introduce legislation to do it. Congress should debate it and vote on it. That's the way to go about this. When you ignore that constitutional process, when you intentionally look for ways to go around it, you're going to run into these kind of immovable barrier meets unstoppable force sort of problems. And I'm not really sure how it ends up.
MBD, segue the exit question to you. How does it end up? Does the Biden administration's student loan forgiveness program get struck down eventually in the courts? Yes or no?
Yes.
Charlie Cook.
Yes, but I worry that it will come too late. The money will have been distributed. It will, in a sense, be a moot point that will only prevent future presidents from doing this. And the incentive structure for presidents to behave in this way, which is not unique to Biden, will remain.
Dominic, I guess you just said you don't know the answer. But I'm asking.
I don't know the answer. I think there's a sense in which it could get struck down de facto if the administration has to keep whittling it down every time somebody finds standing. And so they've already essentially excluded millions of people from this with the two decisions they've already made. So as people continue to find ways to challenge it and they continue to just change it, maybe it'll end up that, you know, three people get debt forgiveness. I don't know. But again, the constitutional problem here is massive.
I'm also going to say yes, that it eventually gets struck down, but it's going to be a long running struggle with that. Quick plug for NR Plus, digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around our extensive, increasingly hardened, metered paywall. You sign up, you log in, you also see 90% fewer ads. It's like magic. The almost medieval level magic, as Dominic was referring to earlier in this episode. You can dig deeper into our community if that floats your boat. You can be part of our private Facebook group. You can comment on articles and blog posts. You can be part of exclusive calls and events. And we have an event out here in the Los Angeles area tonight, just an informal meetup to get together to have some beers with our NR Plus members who are out here. If you are in the area and an NR Plus member, pay a particular attention to your inbox or look back through your inbox. I think invitations have already gone out, but I'm not sure. But anyway, if you're around, we'd love to see you tonight, if you happen to hear this podcast actually before this evening. And we have first-time deals running at any given moment. So it's a great deal and a really important way to support our valuable journalism. So please, please, please consider signing up today and joining tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member of NR Plus. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Dominic, you have been checking off new ballparks from your list. You visited Fenway and have a visit to Citi Field coming up on the horizon here.
That's correct, Rich. I went up to visit some friends from college who moved to Boston a couple of weeks ago, and we went to Fenway Park. First time saw the Red Sox there. That was a great experience. One of the great sport environments in the United States. I was really happy to be able to do that. I haven't been to any New York games yet, though, either the Yankees or the Mets. And so the Mets are having their last home series against the pitiful Washington Nationals.
Say that again. I love hearing that.
Coming up here. And so I will be in New York for some National Review related things coming up this week. And so we're making a trip out to Citi Field to see the Mets most likely put the beat down on those Washington Nationals.
You never know. Things get weird in the last week of the season when these games matter against inferior teams. Citi Field's a very pleasant place. So MBD, we're sticking with the baseball theme. You're going to be obsessed with the Mets Braves.
Yeah, Mets Braves series. This is September baseball. This is what you want, or it's what you want when the season begins. It's not necessarily what you want when you are up 10 games on your division earlier in the season and for a great long time. But here we are just before the playoffs, and the Mets are ahead by just one game over Atlanta, who are very good. And they have a series starting tonight, hopefully, weather permitting. And they have their best pitchers lined up to go up against the Braves. And, you know, this is it. This is the season. I'm in all the way.
So, Charlie, breaking news, I actually should have plugged this right at the top. You have a new podcast.
I do. Well, obviously, with Kevin gone to the Dispatch, the 10-year run of Mad Dogs and Englishmen came to an end. I think we did 370 episodes in all. And I didn't want to give up having a second podcast completely. But also, Kevin's irreplaceable. You can't just throw someone else in and say, well, now he's the Mad Dog. So I started a new podcast called the Charles C.W. Cook Podcast. It's a really imaginative name, but easy to Google. And it's up now. First episode went up this morning. It's available on all major podcast networks except Google, because Google's slow. So If you use Google Podcasts, it will be there in a couple of days, but it's not there. But it is on Apple and Spotify and Stitcher and iHeartRadio and anything you could imagine. So if you want to find it, you can either go to the corner. I just put up a post with all of the links and introducing it. Or if you go to podcast.charlescwcook.com, you'll find all of the links where you can subscribe. Or if you can't find it anywhere, just email me.
And part of your first episode, I understand, is a conversation with Dan McLaughlin about the meaning of Aaron Judge's 61st home run. And we should, since we're talking about baseball here, mark that incredible accomplishment. Only three people without juicing in Major League history have hit 60 or very slightly, or 60 or 61. And I mean, this was very, very hard. I don't think he was pressing that much, but he was clearly pressing once he got to 60 and getting walked a lot. And he should, you know, they have about seven games left. He should, unless something goes disastrously wrong, get, you know, 62 or 63. But it just goes to how hard this is. He's basically played every game this season, certainly never been hurt. And if he had just, you know, tweaked a wrist or an oblique or something and missed a week or two, he wouldn't be here, which just even with the kind of season he's been having. So it just gets to how hard it is and how amazing it is what he achieved. I should mention as my light item that out here on the West Coast, because we were here in Simi Valley, National Review Institute had its Buckley dinner last night honoring Larry Kudlow at the Reagan Library beneath that Air Force One. You always see, you know, Republican debates or speeches at the Reagan, big speeches at the Reagan Library. And wow, what a room. Whoever came up with the idea, we're going to hang Air Force One above this space is a genius. And they let you take a little tour through Air Force One, just walking through and seeing a replica of the football, but still very cool. Ken Kachigian, a Reagan speechwriter, his state of the art at the time, you know, circa 1986, typewriters in there. And just the museum at the library is really cool. You know, we're accused by our enemies of being too obsessed with Reagan, maybe justly so at times, but it's just an amazing story. And there are so many things in the library that you're familiar with the event or the speech, but experiencing it, you know, directly again is just really cool and very moving. I love seeing the microphone that Reagan said he paid for in that famous New Hampshire debate. They have it. I love seeing these note cards. You know, he kept these cards where he'd write, came across an interesting fact or a funny story or a quote, you know, he'd write it down and keep it and refer to it and make it part of his repertoire. The first one at the top, he had a little like a big sort of leather wallet where he kept a lot of these. And the first one is a John Stuart Mill quote. So anyway, it was an awesome night. Larry Kudlow, well-deserving of the award. People adore him. And it's been a blessing to be out here. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece called The American Camry by Wells King and Dan Vaughn Jr. It's a piece about Ronald Reagan, specifically how he got the Japanese Ministry of International Trade and Industry to agree to a voluntary export restriction in order to save Detroit. And the effect of it was it did raise the cost of Japanese cars in America for about 5 years while it was in place, but it also caused the Japanese to make unbelievably large investments in America's workforce and manufacturing, which they've continued to do for decades ever since. And it's kind of a great little case study in how a blunt, simple policy can allow a market to function and get you an advantage and an investment opportunity that lasts for decades and outweighs any of the initial costs that you impose by doing it.
I think it's all really right. Way to troll Dominic right at the end of the podcast.
I know.
Doesn't have a chance to reply. Dominic, what's your pick?
Yeah, there'll be a quarter post later today. Don't worry. I think my editor's pick, as I mentioned earlier, is Andrew Stutterford's cover story for the current print issue about Europe's energy crisis. It's a great piece. It's typical Andrew style. It's very grim, but it ends with a Blackadder reference. And it's a great, very good in-depth look at this. I know he's been working on it for weeks now, and so to see the finished product completed and available for the world to read is nice to see.
Charlie, what's your pick?
Dominic, I just want to praise you for your reluctance there, your reticence. I would have launched into why Michael was wrong and said, screw the format of the podcast, but congratulations on your restraint. My editor's pick is our editorial. Joe Manchin did not get played on permitting reform. We've made lots of jokes on this podcast about how I'm the Joe Manchin whisperer, but I did eventually come to the conclusion and wrote as much 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, maybe slightly more, that Joe Manchin is just a tax and spend Democrat, and he really is inconsistent and inchoate in his approach to politics. And that's what we're seeing. And I think this editorial points that out nicely.
So my pick is Charlie's takedown of Paul Waldman's commentary on Biden's student loan forgiveness. As we all know, and we heard earlier, Charlie is full of righteous zeal, justifiably, on this topic. And this is just one in a series. Charlie, you should collect this stuff into a small book. why this is so grotesque, but it was a terrific piece. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National View podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National View Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Dominic. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to NetChoice, Fast Growing Trees, and Segura. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.